Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Trimates. Trimates is the nickname given to a trio of women scientists who studied primates in the wild. Birute Mary Galdikas studied orangutans, Jane Goodall, chimpanzees, and Diane Fossey, gorillas. Each has been profiled in a National Geographic Kids series, the most recent installment being Unforgotten, The Life and Legacy of Diane Fossey. Anita Silvey is the author of the series, and she joins me now to discuss the life and tragic death of Diane Fossey. Welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you.
Now, Diane, she was an unusually brave child, even. And you begin the book there. Will you tell us what she tried to do to help children in Europe after World War II?
Well, she decided she was in San Francisco, and she had been reading about, the plight of children in World War II, and she decided she needed to go over to Europe and save them. So she went down to the docks and was planning on getting on a boat that would take her to Europe. I'm not sure that she had completely worked out this plan.
she just showed up.
I think, like many of us who thought we were going to run away in childhood, I don't think we actually thought through all the steps of it. She had not. And by the time she got down to the docks, they found her and got her back to her parents. So this never happened. But obviously, even as a young child, she had that kind of empathy for others, and that people might not be as well off as she was. Diane Fossey went through the Depression very well off, by the way. That, of course, is not usual, and was not usual for most families of the time. And her stepfather made a lot of money. And so she had, a privileged upbringing in terms of monetarily. And, they gave her horse riding lessons and all kinds of things like that. But it was a very cold household, and she didn't have, I think she never had love and support. And so she turned to animals. That was where she could find that unconditional love.
Even from the beginning as a child.
That's right. Even from the beginning as a child, that kind of acceptance, that dogs would give, or that a horse that she was riding would give. She wanted pets, but her family only allowed her a goldfish. So, that isn't kind of the loving warmth that you need from, No. They don't look at you in the way a dog looks in your eyes and makes you feel that, you're the most wonderful creature on earth. Mm. So she immediately, from the beginning, she's just really connected to animals. When she finally goes to work as an occupational therapist in Louisville, Kentucky, and now she can have animals, and she has a farm. And by the way, she has every conceivable animal that you could have in Kentucky. She just, cats and dogs and everything is roaming the farm, and she seems to be the happiest when she is surrounded by them. I was fascinated to learn that, by the way, she repeats this pattern in her Africa station. So she's up in the mountains of Africa, and she has a dog, she has a blue monkey, she has chickens, Lucy and Desi, who, lay eggs and provide breakfast, but she has all kinds of birds. So she creates a menagerie, even though, she's out in the wilderness. So,
and didn't she even at one point kind of redecorate her hut with branches inside for a couple of were they monkeys? I'm not sure which that she had taken in.
Yeah, she took in two gorilla babies.
Oh, they were gorillas. Okay.
That had been captured, and they were going to the Cologne Zoo. And she in Germany, and she was horrified to hear about this. And so she went down and she badgered them. And the person who needed to keep them alive admitted that he didn't have any clue how to keep these two gorilla infants, alive. Mm. So he gave the Coco came first and Pucker came second. And yes, she redecorated her entire cabin. She put branches in. She, it was a jungle gym for young gorillas, and she lived with them all the time. She nurtured them, got them healthy, got them well, and I think was always hoping that they would never come and reclaim them, that she would never have to give them up. Mm-hmm. But in point of fact, they had been promised to someplace, and she eventually had to leave them. But in that time, because she wasn't as close to gorilla families as she's going to get, it gives her a lot of chance to observe young gorillas and, what would be their behavior, and also to figure out what kind of formula they needed, what they needed for nurturing and to make them healthy. So it was not only that she had two young gorillas living with her for companionship, it was that she could now figure out how could we take care of gorillas if, in fact, you know, you found one who was an infant and who was not with a family. Mm. So it was also a really important scientifically.
Well, when did she first see a gorilla in the wild?
She was 32 years old, and she went for a 7-week safari in Africa. And she, by the way, she took every cent out of her bank account. She got a loan. You know, she had to do all of that. And she saw all these incredible animals. I mean, you know, what one sees on an African safari. I mean, lions and, you know, giraffe and, you know, just antelope and all of the things that she saw. And her last stop was going into the mountains near Rwanda. And there, for the first time, she saw mountain gorillas. And I really always liken it to, you know, those stories that you hear of human beings who say across a crowded room, they catch somebody's eye mm-hmm. and they know that's the one,
love
you know,
at first that sight kind of
love thing. At first sight. Mm-hmm. That's it. I'm, you know, and in many cases they do marry them, you know, well, this was it. I mean, this was just, it was instant. She felt an incredible kinship with them. And she knew she had to be able to get back to see them. So she goes back to, you know, Louisville. She goes back to her practice, and she starts to write newspaper articles about what she saw, about her trip, but mainly about the gorillas. And then in a small miracle, Louis Leakey comes to give a lecture in Louisville. And after that lecture, she presses up to him, and she has the columns to give him. And she says
he's a famous anthropologist at this point.
That's right. He is the famous anthropologist who's found some of the earliest of human mm-hmm. bones. Mm-hmm. And he wanted particularly women researchers to go into the wild and study our ancestors, you know, study those animals, not exactly ancestors, but those animals who have an enormous amount of the same DNA as mm-hmm. we do, mm-hmm. because he thought that way we would understand more about early man.
And, now, why women? Because he's the one who kind of set up Berute and Jane Goodall and now Dian Fossey, right? Didn't he support all three of them?
That's it. That's why they're called the Trimates. Mm-hmm. They were all, you know, they were all his. He thought that women made better observers than men, and that women were less likely to bring theory to what they were looking at and more likely to observe what they were looking at.
Now, that may be a backhanded compliment right there, but we'll just leave that. And
we'll leave it. At any rate, that was what he thought. And by the way, he was very successful in it. So we're grateful. We're grateful that he had that insight, because all three of them, of course, are going to be terrific observers.
True.
Chimpanzees share 99% of our DNA, and gorillas share 98% of our DNA. And so that's why he wanted to see how they behaved in, you know, all of their interactions, because maybe we could understand human beings more. So he's impressed with Dian. He says to her, let's have breakfast. They have breakfast, and he goes and finds the financing from National Geographic and a couple of other places to send her into Africa, into the mountains, to start her study of mountain gorillas.
And how hard is it to become accepted by gorillas? Because I understand they're pretty social, and so you really have to kind of be allowed in, I would think, to truly observe.
That's right. Well, because gorillas are working so closely in family groups, they've really got to trust you to come into that family group. Mm. So there are techniques that Dian used. You know, she would go out and she would mimic their behavior. You know, she'd scratch the way they scratched, and she'd walk on her knuckles the way they walked on their knuckles. She'd belch the way they would belch. They used to sing a bit in the sun, and she would blend her voice into them. And she'd just stay there quietly and peacefully as if she were one of the group. And one day, and the amazing thing about this day is that it's actually caught on camera because National Geographic had sent Bob Campbell, their animal photographer, to see what Diane was doing because her research was so good. One day, a male adolescent that she had named Peanuts, and he was strutting about and doing his things and slapping things. And Diane stood there and she started to scratch, and Peanuts looked at her and he started to scratch. And then she put her hand out, and he came over and put his hand out and grabbed her hand. And she was holding hands with a gorilla. And Peanuts runs off back with his friends and, you know, plays about. And Diane Fossey said she wept with tears of joy that day because, as she said, she believed she was the first person to hold hands with a gorilla.
And you put that picture right up front in your book. It's pretty
That's
powerful.
How I start the book. I didn't think there was any better start to a story. You
right.
know, this is, after all, a love story between people and gorillas, and we might as well get on with them holding hands, you know. So it seemed to me the ideal way to start a love story.
Oh, now, she starts out, I think, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and there's some political conflict, and she ends up in Rwanda. Were the gorillas different in Rwanda?
They were only different. It was many of the same gorillas, by the way. One of the reasons she wanted to go to Rwanda, she had been studying some of those same groups. You know, they don't know what country they're in. I mean, they were just wandering in the mountain range. So she knew she could, that her first bit of research wouldn't be for naught. But definitely the ones in the Rwanda side had not seen many tourists. They'd not seen many people. And they were much shyer. It took her longer to make connections with them than it did in some. I mean, she's literally sitting with a gorilla group with her guide, Saweki, within 2 days of arriving at her camp in the Congo. And so it was a little harder for her to gain their confidence. But, of course, eventually she does. And eventually they really become like family to her. You know, they accepted her into their families, and she really thinks of them as her family.
We're speaking with Anita Sylvie. She's the author of Undaunted, The Wildlife of Birute Mary Galdakas and Her Fearless Quest to Save Orangutans, Untamed, The Wildlife of Jane Goodall, and now Unforgotten, The Life and Legacy of Diane Fossey. Later in her career in Africa studying gorillas, she develops an approach called active conservation. What is that?
Well, it was a very controversial. She took the law in her own hands at one point. At one point, she really just basically goes over the edge because poachers are getting the gorillas, people's cattle are coming into their range. She seems to have lost kind of perspective. And by the way, everybody's warning her against this. I mean, Jane Goodall basically said, we all told Diane she couldn't do this. I mean, this was, you know, I mean, she's not even a citizen in Rwanda, much less, you know, I mean, she's a guest there. She doesn't run the law there. And she became really virulent in her practices of trying to protect what's now her family. You know, she wanted to protect her family from the poachers and from the people that would harm them. And in this, even the students that she had trained, they were very concerned about this. You know, they thought there were other ways to accomplish some of what she wanted to accomplish. So this is a period that isn't particularly one of her more admirable periods in her life. Clearly, she'd lost some kind of perspective. And then in the middle of this, her favorite gorilla, who was Digit, and she named him because he had a finger missing because he'd been caught in a trap. Digit is killed and by poachers. And she just goes mad. I mean, she just goes mad with grief. I mean, it's like a, you know, the only thing I can liken it to is a mother loses her favorite child, you know, through a tragic death. And she was so unbalanced at this point that all of her friends basically said to her, you have got to get out of Rwanda now. You know, you just can't stay here. And they did say someone will kill you. You know, you really have moved into territory that you cannot move into. Fortunately, she took their advice. At that point, she went back to the United States. She went to Cornell and she taught there, and she was loved by students. She was voted their favorite teacher, and she lectured around the United States, and she wrote her book, Gorillas in the Mist. And even, by the way, she appeared on the Johnny Carson show, a very big show at that time, a nighttime show. And she did gorilla noises for Johnny Carson, which just made him very happy. It's a very funny segment. You know, he just loved, because she could really do a great gorilla sounds.
We actually have a clip of that. Here she is. She is Johnny Carson greets her, and she actually just launches right into her gorilla sounds. And then she talks to both Johnny Carson and Ed McMahon in gorilla speak. And Johnny thinks it sounds a little familiar to the way Ed McMahon shows up to work. Let's take a listen.
Can I ask you a question? You imitate him, I know.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
They like that. Huh? What does that mean exactly?
Well, what does he think it means?
I'm your friend.
I'm contented, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, I've heard it. Ed does that every morning. I mean, forget that. He comes in the office.
Oh, I love that Johnny Carson clip. It catches Diane's personality so well, and it's so much fun. I'm glad you have a clip of it.
So she's starting to improve being back in the U.S.
You know, she got healthy. She stabilized again. She was at a much better place in her life.
She was physically sick as well as mentally unstable,
yeah.
Right?
She had pneumonia. She had broken bones. Her teeth were in terrible shape. She had to have her appendix out. Yeah, she really got run down physically as well while she was out in the wilderness setting. So she finally gets healthy again. I mean, she gets mentally healthy. She gets physically healthy. I think everyone, even those back in Rwanda, hoped that she would stay in the United States. I think that was really what everyone wanted for her, that this, you know, and by the way, that's what most animal researchers do. They attach themselves to a university, and every now and then they go back to their camp and they let graduate students and doctoral students run it otherwise. You know, I mean, that's the usual practice. Very few animal researchers stay out in a station for the rest of their lives. But she couldn't be away from the gorillas. She wanted to get back to them.
And so this is when the real tragedy occurs. And it's interesting because this is a book for kids. And you really don't shy away from the tragedy and all the, you know, the mistakes that she made in she was arresting people and even kidnapping people. And she held a child hostage, you know, a poacher's child hostage, if I understand it. I mean, she really did some tough things, and you don't shy away from it in your book. Were you torn about that?
No, I was never torn about it. I knew that if I had to write about her, if I was going to write about her, I didn't have to, you know, I wanted to, I was going to have to make her murder understandable. That, you know, that the otherwise, you know, it wasn't that just some random person showed up at the camp and, you know, killed her. It was that she had laid the seeds of that by her own actions. Of course, you know, when you're writing for kids, I mean, I'm trying very carefully to choose the words to make sure, you know, not to over sensationalize it. But I think I'm a great believer kids deserve the truth, you know, even when the truth is difficult, that I don't want to sugarcoat a story that I shouldn't. I was really so lucky because in writing about Berute Geldikas and Jane Goodall, I mean, you know, it wasn't that I had to really leave anything out because it was sensational. I mean, Jane had broke so many men's hearts that it was pathetic, but I wasn't writing her love story. I mean, if I had to write Jane Goodall's love story, it really would have been, you know, I mean, she just, you know, probably still does to this day in her 80s, I have to say. You know, she's an enormously attractive woman. And she just, you know, the men came and went. But I never had to tell that story because I wasn't telling the story of her romantic escapades. I was telling the story of her research. So, but I knew with Diane that I was going to have to come as close to the truth. I really had to talk about your father was an alcoholic. Diane becomes an alcoholic. And there is an enormous amount of, you know, the students who worked for her recorded all of that. So I knew I had to tell that story as well as mm-hmm. she kind of descends into alcoholism. You know, I would rather it have been a happy story. I would rather Diane have stayed in the United States and, you know, she'd still be with us. I mean, we would have her here today, but, as long as I did not overdo the way I did, I wrote about this for children, I felt I would be okay. Of course, the good thing in this is I have an editor who looks at it. I have a specialist who looks at it. I have the head of the Diane Fossey Institute, who does a reading, Ian Redman, who worked with her, did a full reading at the end. So I had people I could rely on who would say, you know, no, this is, you know, this is mm-hmm. accurate and, you know, it needs to be said. So
We're almost out of time, but tell us the story of it's around Christmas time when she's killed.
Yes, she is killed. Somebody comes to her camp and they believe the door is open for this person and there's a long struggle and she is murdered. So they believe it is possibly somebody that she might know. When they bring, you know, they don't have really terrific police forces there. They don't have DNA analysis that we have now. They contaminated the scene of the crime and they were not able to figure out who it was. And by the way, she had been waiting for the film crew that was going to film Gorillas in the Mist, was supposed to come right after Christmas. So, they arrive in the camp and, the Christmas decorations are still up and, Diane, who they thought they were going to work with is now dead. They had charged people, but they dropped the charges. And as they say, to this day, nobody knows. Most people assume that someone in the government didn't want her there mm-hmm. because she had created many, many problems and someone was sent to her. But again, no one knows. But she was buried. She had set up a graveyard for the gorillas there and put them gravestones. And so she was buried next to Digit, next to the gorillas that she loved. And there's a beautiful stone over her grave. I sort of end with it, but you know, Diane Fossey, no one loved gorillas more. You know, here you are basically in this sacred place, home where you belong. And so I think she is where she would want to be. And the good thing about this story is she trained so many people to care about these gorillas. She got so attracted so much attention to them that the work goes on, even though Diane can't carry it on.
Anita Silvey is the author of Undaunted, The Wildlife of Birute Mary Galdikas and Her Fearless Quest to Save Orangutans, Untamed, The Wildlife of Jane Goodall, and now Unforgotten, The Life and Legacy of Diane Fossey. Anita Silvey, thank you for joining us on Constant Wonder today.
Oh, thank you so much.
This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor.
And I'm Marcus Smith. We'll continue this discussion about rather large and imposing primates with a story about a pair of gorillas that transformed the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. Stay tuned for more Constant Wonder. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We've been talking about the life and legacy of Diane Fossey, the renowned gorilla researcher. We're turning now to the story of two gorillas taken captive as babies and transported to the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. These baby gorillas were born before Diane Fossey made her most important discoveries, and their time at the zoo transformed the way we've come to understand animal captivity. Eric Schultzke of our Constant Wonder team spoke with author Kara Arundel about the crucial role played by her father-in-law in this story. Kara Arundel, is author of Raising America's Zoo, How Two Gorillas Transformed the National Zoo.
The inspiration for this book was my father-in-law, Nick Arundel. And Nick Arundel was a private citizen. He owned several newspapers in Northern Virginia. And I met him when I graduated from college and started working at one of his newspapers. I didn't meet his son, who I'm married to now, Tom, till 5 years after I left that newspaper. But he is a Renaissance man. He owned newspapers. He served as a Marine in Korea and Vietnam. And he fell in love with the National Zoo when he was a young child. He went to the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. quite a bit as he was growing up. And when he was 8 years old, he decided the National Zoo should have giraffes. So he started a neighborhood newspaper advocating for giraffes for the National Zoo.
Okay, now I want to cut in here. As he wrote, his newspaper was called Nicky News, as I recall, right?
Nicky's News.
Yeah, Nicky's News. Now, he had no formal connection to the zoo. He was just a local fan of the zoo when he was a kid.
Absolutely. He never worked for the National Zoo. I also don't work for the National Zoo or the Smithsonian Institution, of which the National Zoo is a part of. He was just an interested kid who grew up to be a very interested man in the National Zoo and wanted to make the National Zoo better and did what he could to help out.
Okay, so he started with the giraffes, and how did he manage on that project?
Well, he told, as an eight-year-old, when he started his newspaper, he urged the readers to send money directly to the President of the United States to pay for the giraffes. But luckily, the National Zoo and the National Geographic Society went on an expedition about the same time to collect a variety of species from Africa, the East Indies, and Asia, and including giraffes from Africa. And when those animals came to America, it was the largest and most unusual assortment of live animals to have come in one shipment. And that was in 1937.
Okay, but he actually did, though, play a role in galvanizing the public. I mean, he was a big deal. Nicky was, right?
Well, yes. Again, he was eight. But he did act like a veteran Capitol Hill news reporter by going to hearings on Capitol Hill and selling his newspapers and getting a readership that included senators and congressmen. He charged them extra for the copies of his newspaper. So, yeah, the other press in the city caught on to Nicky's agenda and wrote stories about Nicky's News and his push for giraffes.
Now, you say he went to hearings. My recollection is he actually testified at hearings.
No. He was there as a junior reporter covering a hearing.
Okay, but he did speak with congressmen, though. I mean,
Yes, and his father, Russell, also worked on Capitol Hill, not as a congressman, but as an aide.
Okay, now I'm gonna fast forward you in just a minute to Nick and the gorillas. But before I do that, I want to take a pit stop at how the world was approaching its relationship with gorillas at this time. And I want you to tell me the story of a man named Coolidge who went to collect a specimen in a rather disturbing fashion.
Right. So Coolidge, he was a scientist, and he really wanted to understand gorillas. So he went to Africa, and he tried to track the gorillas. And this is early on. This is in 20s, 30s, and he tried to classify gorillas because what was happening was gorillas are only located in equatorial Africa. So there wasn't much knowledge about it collectively around the world, but there were skulls that were collected, parts and papers in different museums and institutions in Europe. And what he tried to do is look at all of that information and try and classify the gorilla.
So what you're doing right now is you're trying to contextualize what he did, but tell us how he brought home an intact gorilla. Because I think this is important to understand how this story evolves, our relationship with the gorillas, right?
Right. Well, he worked at Harvard University at the time, and he wanted to get a gorilla to display. At the time, there were very few gorillas in America. It was just very difficult to, first of all, find and capture them in the African jungle. But if you did, transporting them across the Atlantic was very dangerous. And then gorillas didn't live in captivity very long. So unfortunately, he had to shoot the gorilla and then transport that body to America so he could study it and display it.
And that paradox really underlies a lot of your narrative, is that there's a certain kind of violence that is regrettable in our relationship with these animals from the very beginning, right?
Absolutely. Even the early scientists who wanted to study and save some certain species, they were conflicted because in that time, the only way to really study these animals, large, harder to capture animals, was to kill them and then transport the bodies, dissect them, measure the skulls, examine the stomach contents, and compare that work with others who had done the same. And they, you know, there was regret to that because in order, they felt they were trying to save the species by understanding it better, but they had to kill animals.
Yeah. Now, let us then fast forward. When was it that Nick is a young adult at the time he starts working on the gorilla project?
Right. So after his Mickey News days, he grew up and served as a Marine in Korea and Vietnam. And then after his military time, he went on a pleasure safari with his parents to Africa in 1955. And he knew now at that time that the National Zoo wanted to display gorillas, which were still very hard to find and capture in Africa. And the National Zoo had been trying for decades to get gorillas without success. And during this trip, he got a pair of baby gorillas, a boy and a girl, and he brought them back to America on a commercial airline while they wore diapers and while passengers were feeding the baby gorillas with bottles. And then once he got to America, he donated the baby gorillas to the National Zoo.
Okay, now you fast forwarded over a lot of interesting material there, and I'm going to push you back on that a little bit.
Okay.
How in these days, and actually, as I understand it, it's still the case that if you want to capture a baby gorilla from the wild, you have to shoot the mother, right?
Yes. Well, that doesn't happen now. It's not supposed to happen now, but that was the practice at the time. Obviously, capturing a 400, 500-pound gorilla, adult gorilla, would be very, very difficult and dangerous. So what hunters did was track a family, a troop of gorillas, until they sort of worn down or there was an opportunity to capture the babies. And sometimes that opportunity didn't come up. So the parents who were guarding the babies were shot.
Okay, so then you get to a really, I mean, one of the most fascinating things about your book is how matter-of-factly you deal with some very unusual aspects of your husband's father's story. He says that he told people over the years that he actually hunted down, killed the mothers, and captured those babies. But you're skeptical that it happened that way.
Exactly. Yes. So when I was dating Tom, I asked his father, how did you capture these gorillas? This is such an unusual story. And he told me at the time, it's a sad story. He didn't want to talk about it. So I never asked him about it again. And other people were very curious. But when he came back in 1955 with these gorillas, he talked openly about it and told people that it had to happen in a brutal way. And I'm sure you can imagine 1955, when there was no protections on these animals to hunt or to import or export, that coming back to America saying you captured a pair of baby gorillas, that's almost heroic. Nowadays, that's very bad.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. You probably, as I remember the Curious George stories.
Right.
Which is all about capturing, I guess it's a monkey or a chimp. I'm not sure what it is that they're supposed to be capturing. But it all seems so kind of like cute and harmless and trappy.
Right.
And yet the hunter always is carrying a gun.
Well, I think that's a main point of the book. No matter how you feel about having animals in captivity, we must understand how and why animals got to zoos and how accredited zoos have contributed to conservation efforts.
Eric Schultzke in conversation with Kara Arundel. Arundel is author of Raising America's Zoo, How Two Wild Gorillas Helped Transform the National Zoo. Their conversation continues in just a moment with the dubious, violent beginnings of this story. And the whole story actually paved the way for a greater understanding of animal captivity. Stay tuned for more Constant Wonder. This is Constant Wonder, and now we're going to rejoin the conversation with Eric Schultzke and Kara Arundel about the two baby gorillas her father-in-law donated to the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. We're going to hear how these same gorillas transformed the way we view the captivity of animals in zoos.
In 1955, there were a male and a female. The male was Nkumba, the female was Mocha. And about 6 years after they got to the National Zoo, in 1961, they had a baby. And Tomoko was born. When he was born, he was the fourth gorilla born in captivity in the whole world, and only the fourth gorilla born in captivity in America. And so, as you can imagine, zoo leaders at the National Zoo, other zoos, had no experience with gorilla births and newborn gorillas. So they didn't know what to expect. And when Tomoko was born, they were worried that Mocha was being neglectful to him. So they removed the baby from the National Zoo, from his parents, and brought him to the zookeeper's home to be raised for the first few months of his life. And there he was treated almost like a human baby. He wore diapers. He sat at a high chair for meals, and he even went on errands to the grocery store with the family.
What was the name of the surrogate mother again? Because she factors in again and again.
Louise Gallagher. And she was married to Bernard Gallagher, who was the zookeeper.
And how many gorillas did she nurture as infants?
I think it was three. It was the three that Mocha and Nkumba had. I believe.
Okay. It took a long time. I don't know whether it was the environment, because at some point they were actually trusting the gorilla moms to keep the babies. But initially there was like they would just lay the baby on the concrete and walk away, right?
Well, that's the whole interesting trajectory of the evolution of zoos. You know, again, in 1955, zoos didn't have the information about natural gorilla behaviors. It wasn't until Diane Fossey and other researchers went to remote African locations to study gorillas in their natural habitats, and that information was shared with zoos. So that zoos understood that gorilla moms are sometimes a bit more rough with their newborns than human moms are with their babies. It was also what was happening, too, is that zoos started cooperating with each other. Before 1960s and 50s and 50s, 60s and 70s, zoos were pretty competitive with each other. They didn't share best practices. They didn't share animals. It was run like a business. And that started changing too. So all of these things fell into place about the same time where there were more international conservation agreements and the Endangered Species Act was passed. In America, all those things started working together to really for zoos to better understand how to better care for their gorilla population.
So I take it from what you're saying that one of the things we learned was that a mother's behavior initially after birth may not – well, there was one case where the baby was left inside the amniotic sac, but I guess that may have been an exception to the rule.
Right. I think you're talking about the first gorilla ever born at a American zoo, and it was a surprise birth. And, you know, I don't know if it was because the gorilla didn't know what to do or the zoo didn't know what to do, but that gorilla survived thanks to the quick thinking of zoo folk.
Mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. I just wanted that image out there for somebody to
yes.
Because when you think of the drama of what's going on here, I mean, you're talking about finding a newborn gorilla in the amniotic sac, breaking it open, and giving that gorilla mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. I mean, you can't make that up.
Yeah, a dedication of people who take care of the animals is strong.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the net result, because obviously we have to try to cover a lot of ground in a little bit of time. But over the years, you mentioned that the zoos started cooperating. And one of the things that they did, you explain in your book, is they started treating all of their captive gorillas as being part of a single community. So they would move them back and forth for breeding purposes and for other purposes to maximize their well-being, right?
Exactly. They wanted to have a better genetic diversity rate for a healthier population. And that's where really the cooperation became very strong, knowing that their ability to hunt gorillas from the wild, import gorillas, was ending. So they really had to work together to share their best practices and to learn from each other. And they created a species survival plan for the gorillas. There's also species survival plans for other endangered animals. But with the gorillas, for example, it lays out the management of the population in North American zoos. So it's very, very well managed.
And, yeah, my recollection from your book is that they have a target of genetic diversity. And in fact, and I'm going to take partial credit just because I'm an American, that we have significantly exceeded the minimum target for genetic diversity in this population.
Right. In North America, gorillas are expected to have a 90% genetic diversity rate for the next 400 years. Which means, like, unless something really goes wrong, we will have healthy population of gorillas in zoos in captivity for a long time.
Okay, so you have in the wild right now, tell us what the status of the gorillas is, because this is actually part of the story, because now we have is it about 350 gorillas in North America?
Yes. About that.
And they have very strong reproductive patterns and very strong genetic diversity. They actually have very good prospects. And how are their cousins doing out in the wild?
Yeah, and that's the sad part. In the wild, three of the four gorilla subspecies are critically endangered. There's four subspecies, and western lowland gorillas are the gorillas you see in all North American zoos and most zoos in around the world. So the population of mountain gorillas is slowly increasing, but all wild gorillas are still threatened by poaching, habitat loss, disease, and also climate change. So, critically endangered, if your status is critically endangered, the next level is extinct in the wild.
And so we get to the paradox of, you know, we started with the ethically problematic manner in which the original gorillas in North America were acquired. But now we're in a situation where, had that not happened, the species itself would be much more at risk. I mean, this is actually kind of a Noah's Ark for this species now, right?
Yeah, you could think of it that way. I think there are some who would prefer that all animals stay in their wild habitats. But you also have to understand the knowledge that has been gained from having gorillas in captivity, from the scientist's perspective, from the biologist, but also from the general population. I mean, most people won't be able to go to equatorial Africa to visit gorillas, but they can go to a zoo and see gorillas and watch them and learn from them.
Okay, now your book deals with the gorillas, with your father-in-law. It also deals with the story of the National Zoo. And I am just going to throw out several little tidbits from the book. And I want you to kind of like comment on a few of these. We have a few minutes left here. You have Smokey the Bear, the pandas, Ham the Chimp, the killer lions, and the white tigers. Why do you pick one of those and then you pick your first one and then I'll just like push you from to the next until we run out of time. Which one do you want to talk about first?
Oh, I'd love to talk about Ham the Chimp.
Okay.
Ham was a chimpanzee and he worked for NASA. And he went to space. He was weightless. He was part of the space exploration program and testing out weightlessness and space flight for astronauts. And the NASA space program learned a lot from his service in NASA. And when he retired from NASA, he lived at the National Zoo. And in the book, you know, I say that he didn't have such a happy life at the National Zoo. I think he was a bit lonely. A lot of people came to visit him. He was still known as Ham the Space Chimp, and he had a lot of fans at the National Zoo.
And there are a lot of other stories in there. I mean, obviously, I mentioned a few of them. Smokey, the way we got the pandas from China in the early 1970s. The white tigers is an interesting story because that gets to the whole issue of how you manage a species and genetic diversity when what you really want is a showpiece as opposed to a healthy breeding population. There have been a lot of kind of like discoveries of ethics and science that kind of happen in motion where nobody really knows for sure, right? You just discover it on the run.
That's right. Yeah, with the white tiger, white tigers aren't their own species. And the Mohani, who lived at the National Zoo, was a white tiger, came to the National Zoo in the 1960s, and she was had a lot of fans as well. She was beautiful, and they tried to have breed her to create more white tigers. But the problem was the cubs had a lot of genetic deformities. And that the zoo learned a lot from that because it wasn't the best practice to be breeding her.
Constant Wonder producer Eric Schultzka speaking with Kara Arendelle, author of Raising America's Zoo, How Two Wild Gorillas Helped Transform the National Zoo. We're going to round out this hour on a very different note. We're going to be in outer space next, where the problem of what to eat in space led to the surprising choice of tortillas over bread. And to get more about this, we spoke with Charles Pappas. He's author of One Giant Leap, Iconic and Inspiring Space Race Inventions That Shaped History.
At first, they thought they need about 3,200 calories a day, and then they whittled that down to about 2,500, thinking that they'd be sedentary for much of their space flights. But again, the problems arose. How would you eat? What could you have? And crumbs in space are deeply dangerous. But even then, when you talked early on about, you said that, you know, back in the 19th century, people wouldn't have been thinking about some of these problems, but Jules Verne did. And from in his novel, From the Earth to the Moon, he had a Frenchman cook who whipped up soups, beefsteak, and he even treated the astronauts to a fine Burgundy. So we've been thinking about this ever since. But until we have Star Trek-like conditions, we're not going to be able to eat very well in space. So the idea of how do you have food that can be convenient, that can be safe, nutritious, came up. And the problem, too, is, remember, on these long flights, because the capsules are so small, you can't have refrigerators. You can't have huge storage. You have to have, you know, containers that are easy and small. So for the most part, we started off with a kind of a bite-sized, freeze-dried, dehydrated foods. And they had been prepared by NASA, Whirlpool Corporation, and the U.S. Army Laboratory. So you came out again with Tang. Then for the first long-term flight, which was Gemini 7, which lasted about 14 days, they had each had about 1.7 pounds of food daily. And you got a very basic kind of food pyramid sort of assortment. You had meats, bread, dessert. And again, they were you could rehydrate them. But in those cases, they also found what they had to do was coat as much as possible with oil so that when you're eating them, they don't fly off into space. And they found that even was a danger with toothpaste. And that's why they developed an ingestible toothpaste, because basically brushing could have particles fly off into the cabin. And again, like crumbs from a sandwich. Now, just to give you an idea of how dangerous this was, back to Gus Grissom, on Gemini 3 in 1965, Wally Schirra had given one of the astronauts a sandwich from a deli in Florida. He presented it to Gus Grissom during the flight. And Grissom kind of marveled at it because he was sort of nonplussed, like, why am I getting a corned beef sandwich, you know, in the middle of this flight? Congress was furious because, again, this was to them a scandal. They should only have been eating approved foods. And in fairness, you know, these foods, crumbs from bread, could actually fly off into space. So again, that's why they tended to treat all foods with gelatin or oil, anything that would keep them kind of coherent. And that's why other things like cookies, crackers, bread, forbidden. You
so
just really can't.
What's the hazard of a crumb getting, I guess it gets into equipment?
Into equipment. And again, think about it. Let's say you have three astronauts. You're eating several times a day on, let's say, a 14-day trip. That's an enormous amount of crumbs that can be floating around and getting into equipment. And again, what are you going to do if a malfunction happens and you get an Apollo 13? So that's why even little things like this are incredibly dangerous. And then you have, by default, the staple that people go for in space, tortillas, because tortillas do not crumble. And that's been kind of a food of choice ever since.
Charles Pappas, author of One Giant Leap, Iconic and Inspiring Space Race Inventions That Shaped History. It's quite possible you've heard of the children's books titled A Series of Unfortunate Events. Well, tomorrow here on the show, we're going to take that to the next level with a quirky book on bad days in history. It's an entire calendar year of disasters, large and small. I'm kind of giggling because none of this is gloomy, dark stuff. It's a fun romp tomorrow. Hope you can join us then. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.